The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management. Welcome to What About Wealth? Making it, investing it, protecting it, leaving a legacy with your hosts, Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. In today's economy, preserving wealth has become more important than ever, especially when it comes to our future generations. Now, here is Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee.
Hey, good morning, everyone. This is Rich Bloomfield, and I'm the certified public accountant on this show.
Good morning, good morning. This is Rick Durfee, and I'm the lawyer.
And we like working together, and we think that it really benefits our clients, and that's why we also do this show together, because we found over our collective 40-some-odd years of, or is it 50-some-odd years?
I think it's 50-some-odd years now, yeah. Ouch.
Ooh, that's a lot. That that our clients that have their attorneys and CPAs working together on the same page fare a lot better overall. And we have history to prove it. So we're not just making it up. And so that's why we work together and do these shows together, because we think that if folks listen and both their advisors have all the facts and look at their situation from that perspective, that we come up with really great answers.
Yep.
So
if your lawyer and your CPA give you a different advice, one of them doesn't have all the facts. That's usually how I see it. You can reach us, of course, at whataboutwealth.com. You can find us on YouTube. You can find us on lots of places. You can call us at 480-324-8000. And, of course, right here on the voiceofamerica.com business channel.
All right. Well, Rick, today I think our show is a very important one. I think that maybe a lot of people aren't really going to know why it's so important, but hopefully by the end we will. It's called Financial Statements Made Easy. And so I know you know a lot about financial statements. I think that I do most of the time. And but I see a lot of ones that perplex me. And so we're going to tell some stories about those. We're going to talk about what financial statements should do for you, how they should help you in your business, and things that they won't tell you and things that they do. So anyway, that's what the show is going to be about. But first of all, we need to go to our news that affects your wealth segment. And so, Rick, take it away. Let's see what we've got there today.
Okay, big number one, the huge news this morning is that government is shut down. The politicians failed to reach an agreement on a budget, and there's lots of finger-pointing as to who caused it. As everybody probably knows, and this will date this program for people listening to it that's recorded, the Republicans have submitted three budgets from the House to the Senate, all of which took various levels to defund Obamacare. And, of course, the Senate rejected it, and Harry Reid has just said, no, we don't need to negotiate. And the president has said he doesn't need to offer anything. It's up to the Republicans to just give us what we want. And so with that happy situation going on. The government has been defunded. Now, apparently, according to the news reports, the House has passed a bill funding the military and a few other quote-unquote essential programs, and that flew through the Senate and went to the president's desk. So our soldiers in the field are still going to get paid and still have bullets in their guns and still have a way home when the conflict is over. But other essential or other non-essential quote-unquote government functions have closed down. So, for example, it's now apparently illegal to set foot on the mall in Washington because it's officially closed. Of all the bizarre things, you know, that's probably one of the least expensive things they could fund, opening the mall in Washington with out of the chump chains that falls through the cracks. But they want to affect the public as much as they possibly can. And
just like the sequester.
Yeah, just like the sequester.
Which is so we're a non-news item.
So. Yeah, we're that was supposed to be the end of the world, and I think that it's good, and it's actually I want to refer to with this Obamacare issue that's just here, and these are items in the news. Several promises that were made. We promised that everybody could keep their health care plan. You don't have to give it up. And yet we see hundreds of major employers, thousands of minor employers, including the big unions and others, have been dumping their health care or transitioning their workers from full-time to part-time so they didn't have to provide health care. So the promise that you could keep your existing insurance was a lie. The promise then that you would pay less. That, oh, if we put more people in the program and we hose the rich people, we make the rich people pay more, on average, everybody will pay less. But on average, no, everybody's going to pay more. In fact, we cited a study a week or two ago in our program that the cost is going to go up over $7,500 per person. So this quote-unquote affordable health care is neither affordable nor is it health care. Also, that everyone will be covered. There was all this talk about the so-called 30 or, depending on the study you listen to, somewhere between 30 and 50 million Americans not covered by medical insurance. So we've got to get them covered. Well, Obamacare over the next 10 years is still going to leave at least 31 million people with no medical insurance, even by the year 2023. And then, of course, the promise that it's going to save jobs. This will make it easier for people to employ. And fact has had exactly the opposite effect. Companies are laying off. Companies are going from full-time to part-time. The only place that we have seen job growth is in government employees, people leaving the private sector and moving to the public sector so they can jump on the feeding and the public trough, as my father-in-law always said, getting paid out of the tax collector's slush fund. So that's where the government is, and of course the Democrats and the Republicans are all pointing fingers at each other, and we'll get to see how that comes out.
So, you know, philosophically, this has been a tough thing for me to try to figure out what to do, and obviously that's because I'm probably a really poor politician, but I'm concerned that the public really needs to understand what's going on here, because I think the Republicans are trying to be responsible about this, and because if you do the fact check, which we just gave you some of those, it's pretty clear that that, you know, it's going to cost more, a lot more. That, you know, their assumptions about how they came up with their numbers, that a lot of young people, you know, would buy health insurance on the exchanges rather than, you know, risk some sort of penalty. All those assumptions just aren't playing out, and we're going to see, you know, this thing not only drag down the economy, but you know, just drag down healthcare. So it's a but dealing with it politically is a completely different matter, because my opinion is that if you just let it go, it will collapse under its own, because we've already got 70% of the public that, by pretty much any poll that you look at, that does not want the healthcare law, and because they see what it's doing to their job, their hours, everything else, so it should collapse of its own accord, and then it would be hard to blame it on anyone except for the Democratic-controlled Senate, House, and president that passed it in the first place. But
you know, it's kind of interesting, the idea of what effect does government intervention have in markets. This is another news item. Since 1990, the street price of illegal drugs has been falling, and the purity and potency, on the other hand, has been rather dramatically improving, which means that this quote-unquote war on drugs that's been an international effort has really completely and utterly failed to affect either the supply or the demand for illegal drugs. And this $350 billion a year industry in the U.S. is actually made stronger by its criminal nature. So criminalizing the use of these substances has not reduced their use, nor has it affected the market. In fact, criminalizing has made the market more robust. While on the other hand, the government has been highly effective at killing other markets, and in particular, the government's highly effective at killing markets that it regulates. So, if we truly had the social objective of eliminating the use of these harmful substances, rather than criminalizing them, which simply throws gas on the fire of the market, it would be far more effective to legalize them, decriminalize them, we should say, and then regulate the heck out of them. Regulation has done more to kill markets than criminalization ever did. You'd think that people could figure that one out.
I wonder if Obamacare will have any of that sort of effect on the best healthcare system in the world.
Yeah. So we're going to regulate healthcare, and it'll get better. We promise. That's a famous last words.
Yeah. Not much history that supports that. So.
Another really interesting thing, it's a news item that Spain's public debt is now approaching 100% of their GDP. So I read this news item, and then I went to look at some backup facts. And as it comes out, having debt at or even in excess of gross domestic product is not altogether that unusual. There are a great number of countries that have debt at that level. In fact, many countries have debt above their GDP, including Greece, the notorious Greece that's being bailed out by the European Union, is at 161% of GDP. Iceland is at 119%. Italy is at 126%. Jamaica is at 136%. And the highest is Japan at 214%. And if you care about this sort of stuff, against this backdrop, China, who is the number one country from which we borrow money, is at 31%, one of the lowest countries. And the U.S. is at a whopping 73.6%, still well below many countries. And the world average is at 64%. So as grim as it is, and as much as we have to say, you know, my view is the national debt and the spending and borrowing spree the politicians are on to buy more votes and consolidate their power is not healthy in the long run. But there are others that are worse than us. So I guess
we can feel good about something.
Yeah, we can feel good about something.
Well, it seems that technology companies have taken the fizz out of Coca-Cola. Apple is this year's best global brand, according to a recent report from the marketing firm Interbrand. And Coca-Cola had been that spot for 13 years as the number one brand. Google jumped to second, and Coke fell to third. So these rankings are based on multiple factors, including how well the company's products or services perform financially, how well it influences consumers. So so this accolade, I guess, caps a big month for Apple. 2 weeks ago, the company launched two new iPhones, the low-cost iPhone 5C and the iPhone 5S with an upgraded camera, and that famous fingerprint sensor that everyone is so excited about. So they sold 9 million combined iPhones during the first weekend. So overall, technology companies dominated this year's best global brand list. They got six of the top 10 spots.
Wow.
So that's...
You know, what's stunning to me is I have a teenage son, and here they release this new iPhone, and the same day he comes home from school reporting a pretty significant number of friends that had this new phone at school that apparently their parents went and bought for them. It just blows my mind. Parents are out there buying the phones, not just for themselves, but for their children. So that's a marketing coup for Apple. They've been highly effective at persuading us that we need to buy their stuff. You know, kind of looking at social policy and its effect upon our wealth, last month the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank, and I've met a lot of people from Cato Institute. It's an interesting organization. They added up seven types of benefits that a single mother with two children would receive here in the U.S., and they found that in 39 states, the total package would be worth more than the starting salary for a secretary, and in 11 states, it would be more than the starting salary for a new teacher. So just adding up the economic benefit, it's a single woman with two children is far better off staying home and collecting all of her government benefits than she is going to work at an entry-level job. And of course, these benefits vary significantly from state to state. There are some states like Utah and Minnesota that get good news coverage for using the data to figure out what works. But overall, the system is really, really complicated. It's estimated that there are at least 126 separate programs just at the federal level. So many, and it's so complicated that the poor or even the not poor often have no clue what's out there or how they get it, which, you know, we in the U.S. we're famous for creating self-perpetuating bureaucracies, and they get funded because, oh, if you cut this program, someone somewhere is going to starve, when in fact the main people that would be affected economically are the bureaucrats that would have to go work for some other department in the government. So social policy is alive and well here in the U.S., and you can make more money by living off government benefits than you can by getting an entry-level job. So here we are. Welcome to America.
All right. And Rick, with on that happy note, we need to go to our first break. And so we will come back with the quote of the week right after this break.
Save on your prescriptions with the RX Savings Plus Drug Discount Card offered by Voice America. It is not insurance, and discounts are only available from participating pharmacies. But 9 out of 10 pharmacies participate nationwide. Start saving today. Print your free card online at voiceamerica.rxsavingsplus.com or text the word TALK RADIO to 96362. Live well and leave a legacy. Durfee Law Group offers dynasty estate planning and asset protection services so you can do just that. We focus on helping our clients gain maximum protection and privacy by providing the right tools and innovative strategies to sustain both immediate and long-term success. Call us today to set up a complimentary consultation. Call 480-324-8000. That's 480-324-8000. Or visit our website at www.durfeelawgroup.com. That's D-U-R-F-E-E lawgroup.com. We'll help you turn the gift of wealth into a blessing for your heirs rather than a curse.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Rich. I'm the CPA.
And this is Rick. I'm the attorney.
And this is What About Wealth. And our topic this hour is financial statements made easy. Because we got so carried away with the news, we need to go with our quote of the week here. And so today it is, when the people want a free lunch, they elect a thief. When they want the impossible, they elect a liar.
Who said that?
I don't know.
I don't know either, but ouch. Okay, I'm gonna tell our give back story. It's a short one. This is kind of cool. I like to find things in the news that are positive and that show people doing what they can wherever they are. So Lee Ward out of Huntington, West Virginia, reports that his friend Larry Lucas, who has a very rare illness and is as a result disabled, has been collecting old bikes that needed work, and he does the repairs on them and donates them to Toys for Tots. And over the last year, he has collected and fixed and donated 175 refurbished bikes to two different Toys for Tots drop-off points. And we should note that Larry is unable to work, lives off his disability checks, and has very, very limited resources and is frequently ill because of his condition. So in spite of all this, he's able to find these bicycles, make the repairs, and give them. So I love that, I don't know, kind of American spirit that wherever we are, even in very difficult and maybe desperate circumstances, a person can look around and find a way to make the world a better place. So that's our give back story. We can dive now into these financial statements. I think the financial statements made easy, that's an oxymoron. I want to see if you can really do this for us today, Rich.
It's a funny title.
Make it easy. Come on, make it easy for us. And let me introduce this, I guess. You know, as a lawyer, I get financial statements pushed in front of me all the time, and they expect that I must know something because I deal in business planning and tax planning and kind of financial related issues. And for years and years, I have to confess, I didn't understand a dang thing. I would look at them and try and throw out some buzzwords that made me sound something other than stupid. but it really was not very productive. And I'd have to say something clever like, well, you know, that's why we have a CPA on the team, because they're going to give us, the CPA is going to tell us what this stuff really means. And then some time ago, I discovered, I was reading a book, and I'm sorry, there's no way to say this, but to say who it is, and which might end up promoting the product. But I was reading Robert Kiyosaki's book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, in which he does a very good job of selling you on a game called cash flow. And in this game, the participants, you actually have a financial statement. You have a balance sheet, and you have an income statement. And then this sounds bizarre for a board game, but you were then have various events occur and transactions happen, and you have to take whatever happens in the game and you have to put those consequences in your balance sheet. So you see what it does to your assets and liabilities, and you see what it does to your income and your expenses. And you quickly learn that there are things that we like on our financial statements and things that we don't like. And, you know, I actually took this game to a family reunion in my family. I had a brother-in-law who's a teacher and who's never had two dimes to rub together, got fired up about his financial statements and has actually gone on as a result of this and done a very effective job at accumulating some assets on his balance sheet and some income on his income statement that has really changed his life. So, you know, and I'll just share one of the things that happens is you will say you went to the bulk market and you bought doodads or something. You'll say you bought golf clubs for $800, and you have to ding your financial statements. You have to take something off of your financial statement that was producing income to pay for these stupid golf clubs, and you go, oh, what did I buy the golf clubs for? That was really dumb. So that's my introduction here. Now I want you to know that I have since then learned at least a few things about reading financial statements that I can look to see what are the assets. And it's interesting that in the game, and I think in real life, the things that count the most for assets are things that produce income. And so when I'm looking at a client's financial statements, I'm going to say, you know, well, look at these things over here. How many of them produce income? How many of them are productive? And if they're not, are they really an asset? And then we look at things that because the income shows up on the profit and loss statement. That's in the income category. And then how many of these things, in fact, produce expenses instead of income? And that should tell us something about what we're doing. So with that introduction, Rich, now make it easy for us. How do we understand financial statements?
Well, we're not going to accomplish that in one short show, but at least we're going to scope it out a little bit so that hopefully it'll be some things that we can look at. I just wanted to tell a couple of stories here too. I work with a lot of service businesses, and if you've listened to the show very much, you know that we work a significant amount with dentists and some doctors and then, you know, a lot of other businesses as well. But I'm just shocked every day as I look at financial statements or as we onboard new clients. In fact, I was just looking at one late last night because I speak at an event in Sundance in Utah twice a year, where groups of dentists come and we talk about financial statements and you know, what they mean and how we can make them more effective and a lot of other things. But so I was looking at one last night, and there was something glaringly missing from the financial statement. I was looking at it. I saw assets. I saw liabilities. I saw, the equity statement of the financials, and I saw expenses, but there was no income account. And that was probably the strangest one I've ever seen. You know, I was trying to figure out where they put the deposits when they made them in the bank, so that there was some, you know, because you kind of have to have an offset for every debit that you do. You have to have a credit somewhere. And I found it in accounts receivable on the balance sheet. So anyway, I'm not really sure how they prepare tax returns or anything.
Yeah, I was just wondering if that was a clever way to avoid paying income taxes, because if you don't have any income, you don't have to pay taxes, right?
Right, you just have negative account receivables.
So we can show a loss every year.
So I don't know.
I think the IRS would catch on to that one pretty quick.
Yeah, I think so. So I thought it would be good to just talk quickly about each financial statement, because I think most people have heard the terms, but you know, as far as reading them or really understanding what they're telling them, if you're going to run a business or you have a, you know, no matter how simple your business is, you're going to do better if you really can look at the financial statements and they mean something to you. So let's talk first about the profit and loss statement, or, you know, we often call that the income statement. We hope it's an income statement. And so there are only two, and, you know, when you're looking at financial statements, you just kind of have to realize that there's income, there are expenses, there are assets, liabilities, and then something that makes it all balance, which is the equity section of the balance sheet. So what does that all mean? So I think we all have pretty good concept of income. And, you know, so anything that you generate as far as people paying you money for whatever it is you do or whatever it is you sell, that's going to be the income. And the expenses, believe it or not, are a little more complicated than that. And so we all kind of understand that, you know, if you pay the rent, that's an expense. If you pay your employees, that's an expense. But sometimes you look on there and you see an expense called amortization or depreciation. And, you know, that isn't something that you write a check for. So, but it certainly affects your bottom line, and not from a cash flow standpoint, but in reality, it affects your bottom line, and for taxes, it affects your bottom line. So, you know, what is that? And then, you know, we also have different ways of creating financial statements. Rick, do you know what that is?
Well, I know that I've created them sometimes just by penciling out, okay, you know, sit down with my wife. What where do we have money coming in? Where is the money going out? What do we have, you know, that we could sell?
Yeah.
That somebody would pay us for, and how many loans do we have? So I think even on a crude level, a person can pencil out some simple ideas like that. But,
yeah,
but beyond that, most people get their quote-unquote financial statements out of some computer-generated accounting system like QuickBooks or the
right.
equivalent.
And even in QuickBooks, you know, and I think, you know, there are two large categories of financial statements. One is cash and the other is accrual. And most of us work best on a cash basis because that makes the most sense to us. Cash in, cash out, you know, then whatever's left over, that's kind of the profit. So, but most businesses, most large companies that are out there, use accrual basis accounting, and that's where instead of it really being cash, you know, as things happen, as you know, as expenses or income, those kind of things, even if the cash hasn't hit yet, if you know you've made a sale and you're going to be collecting, then you put that on the income statement, and then, in other words, you accrued some income, you accrued some expenses, and so I think we'll leave accrual accounting to the side for today, because cash accounting is hard enough for most people. But I just wanted to throw out there that there are those kinds of accounting, and that any large company financial statement, if you're an investor and you're looking at Coca-Cola statements, you're going to see accrual accounting. And I guess to most accountants, and I guess to the sophisticated business world, accrual accounting probably matches expenses and income better than cash basis does. So that's why it's used in public companies, Rick.
Yeah, isn't the accrual, isn't that a way of kind of, I guess, looking what's in the pipeline? Projecting not just where the company is today, but what direction it's heading. So you get early indicators to let you know, am I in trouble? Because, you know, it's the famous, you know, the business owner is the last one to find out, oh, my business is in trouble. And the accrual accounting is in theory designed to give early warning signals to the people that should be looking at those financial statements and understanding what they mean.
Right. Because if you sell, goods, for example, let's just say you sell widgets and, you know, you sell those to people and you allow on credit, and basically you allow them to pay you in 20 days or 30 days, you're going to have a lot of sales out there that that you haven't collected cash for. So, and you've probably expended a lot of cash making those widgets. And so on the expense side, you know, you've got these big expenses, and if you're on a cash basis, no income, and so it looks a little funny. So that's why matching with accrual makes a lot more sense in a lot of businesses. The small businesses, it's a lot easier to understand cash, which is, you know, just cash in, cash out, and whatever's left over. So, but even then, Rick, there's a couple of items that you see, that you regularly see on a financial on a profit loss statement that people wonder about because they can't quite figure out how they got there. And those two, the two major ones are depreciation and amortization. And without those, you're not really going to know. I do this with clients all the time. We'll be looking at financial statements. They're financial statements that we haven't cleaned up for them yet. And they'll show a rather large income for the year. But when we actually start preparing the tax returns, then sometimes they end up with a loss, or certainly end up with a lot smaller income. And so there's always the question of, gee, how do we do that? And not that they're unhappy about it, but because they have the same amount of cash, but they paid less tax. And that's because when you purchase large items, like a building or large pieces of equipment, cars that you use in your business, or machines that make your widgets, then you're not allowed to expense those or show them as an expense in the first year. You have to stretch that out over time. And so so you you buy a large piece of equipment to run your business. Say it costs $100,000, and you made $100,000 at your bottom line, then you might think, wow, I didn't make any money because I can write that off. Under some circumstances, for tax purposes, you could do that, but typically for financial statements, you'll spread that over 5 years or 7 years, depending on the type of equipment, and you get to take your 20% or whatever percentage it is of that each year and write it off as depreciation. And so you'll see those show up on your financial statement. And it is a true way of thinking about your profit and loss, because you did have to expend money to buy that machine. You didn't get to write it off when you bought it. And it's losing value over time, typically, as it gets older, and so you take it as an expense ratably.
Now, and so, now I just have a question, a practical question, thinking through this. Do you have to keep track of that kind of stuff on a separate schedule, a spreadsheet, or a piece of paper somewhere, or do accounting packages like QuickBooks, is there a meaningful way to do that inside the package? I have no clue. So I assume if I don't know, neither do our listeners. How does that work in terms of, because this sounds like complicated stuff when I do my informal casual pencil it out on a napkin, I would have no clue how to include that sort of thing.
Right, that's exactly right, and most people don't. But yeah, there is inside of any accounting package, including QuickBooks, there is a section. And really, this happens kind of as a subset of the balance sheet, where you enter your assets, your fixed assets, which are is an accounting term for cars and trucks and machines and anything that buildings. And so you enter them there, and depending on the package that you have, you can assign a life to those assets. And and depreciation is a very complicated area because it's been made that way by the politicians as they try to pass tax legislation. But even for financial accounting standards, it's pretty complicated, and you have to assign a life and a methodology for how that happens. But yeah, there is a separate schedule called a depreciation schedule that keeps track of all that. It has a list of it and shows how much has been depreciated and how much is still left and that.
We'll come back to this, and we'll talk about balance sheets when we come back from break.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Live well and leave a legacy. Durfee Law Group offers dynasty estate planning and asset protection services so you can do just that. We focus on helping our clients gain maximum protection and privacy by providing the right tools and innovative strategies to sustain both immediate and long-term success. Call us today to set up a complimentary consultation. Call 480-324-8000. That's 480-324-8000. Or visit our website at www.durfeelawgroup.com. That's D-U-R-F-E-E lawgroup.com. We'll help you turn the gift of wealth into a blessing for your heirs rather than a curse.
Voice America Business Network. The bottom line in business.
You are tuned in to What About Wealth with Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. If you have a question or comment about our program, please send an email to info@whataboutwealth.com. That's info@whataboutwealth.com. Now back to Rick and Rich.
Welcome back. This is Rick Durfee. I'm the lawyer.
And this is Rich Bloomfield, and I'm the CPA.
And this is What About Wealth? And today we are talking about financial statements made easy. And we've just heard a whole bunch about profit and loss statements and cash versus actuarial and how we handle depreciation.
Or accrual.
Oh, accrual. Yeah. Oh, I can't think and read at the same time. Thank you. But now let's talk to us a little bit about balance sheets. What is a balance sheet, and how do they work, and why do we care?
Okay, so, and that's a good question. Most people don't know the answer to that, and most people, in fact, don't care. So, but they should. If you're going to run a business, you should care about the financials, about the balance sheet, because that's really kind of what's going to tell you what's happening. And if you ignore that, you could be in for a rude awakening at some point. So you kind of alluded to it, Rick, in your story about the cash flow game, because every time you dip into to your cash to purchase something, whether that is it going to be something that makes you money, or is it going to be something that you're just spending money on, like your example of the golf clubs. That takes a big chunk of your cash, so you no longer have that to use in the business. And if you take it to, to have a great vacation, or not that you shouldn't do that occasionally, but if you do that too often, Then you take your asset, which in that case would be a cash, and you convert it to an expense, which has no revenue that it generated for you. So in looking at the balance sheet, I guess the important things to look at, obviously, are, and let's first of all, let's say, why is this thing called a balance sheet? And the reason that it is that it's called a balance sheet is because you list the assets of the business. And let's use the obvious ones: cash, equipment, and let's just leave it at that and say, you know, we've got two things on the balance sheet. You got your cash, you got your equipment, and that's in the asset section. And then you've got liabilities. And of course, I think we all know what liabilities are. Those are the things that you owe other people. And so let's say that you have kind of common liabilities on there. You've got payroll taxes that you owe the government, and you have a loan that you took out to start the business that you owe to other people, or if you're lucky, to the bank. And so the difference between those two, which we hope you'll have more assets than you have liabilities, but that isn't always the case. But the third section on the balance sheet is called the equity section. And so this is most easily understood by thinking about your house, because we've all had a house that actually had some equity. A lot of us have probably had houses that had negative equity.
So some people can remember when you could buy a house and over time it would go up in value. I've heard of that happening.
Yeah, and I think it's been happening recently in Phoenix, but prior to that, it went the other direction for quite a while. So if you buy the house and you put some money down and then you borrow the rest, then the resulting difference is your equity. And sometimes that's just the cash you put in when you first purchased it. But as Rick mentioned, over time, hopefully it goes up in value. And you might actually have some positive amounts there. But usually the balance sheet is just based on cost, or what you paid for it to begin with. So over time, as you pay down the debt, then the equity will get larger. So that happens in a business too. And so you have assets, you borrow money, and you put that into some sort of product or service that over time you can sell for a profit. And that profit, when it comes onto your balance sheet as cash, will increase the assets over time, your equity section should grow if you have a profitable business. And so that's kind of how a balance sheet works, and that's why it's called a balance sheet, because the equity and the liabilities equal the assets, or the other way around.
You know, I want to comment on this, Rich, because this is an area where, I'm going to set this up and then have you address this issue. There's a relationship between the balance sheet and the P&L sheet. And in theory, on your balance sheet, you will have assets that produce income that shows up on your profit and loss statement. And so, but a lot of people have things that they're listing on their balance sheet as an asset, but it's instead of generating income on their profit and loss, they're generating expenses. And so talk to us about how those two affect each other. How does the balance sheet and the profit and loss sheet play off of each other? And what do we need to pay attention to?
Okay, so as you mentioned, Rick, you have to use your assets, whether that's cash or equipment, to generate income. That's, you know, if it's a building that you've got on your balance sheet, you're renting that thing out, and the rent is going to come in as an income item on the P&L, and then you have to, you know, pay to keep the lights on and, you know, pay the taxes on the building. And those things will be expenses that come out of the rent income, but the resulting profit will increase, theoretically, the cash balance over time. And so the way they're related and the way financial statements ultimately balance so that it all balances out when you have your assets, liabilities, equity, is that the income on the P&L statement also is an entry in the equity section of the balance sheet. So if you have $100,000 in income at the bottom line in your P&L statement, you'll also see for the current year, there'll be a line item called net income on the balance sheet, which is confusing to people a lot of the time. But the reason that it's there is because if you made income for the year, then it's got to show up in the balance sheet. Otherwise, the balance sheet won't balance because that's that's the piece of your equity that you grew in the current year. And then once the current year is over, then that net income goes to another account called retained earnings, which is also in the equity section. And those are just the accumulated profits over time. And then you start over, and the net income will either grow or shrink depending on what's happening on the P&L side. So anyway, once you understand the relationship between the two, then you're able to start thinking about, okay, are my assets generating income, and or are they just generating expenses? Because as you mentioned, Rick, there are assets. For example, if I have an office building in Phoenix, which I do, and I don't have it fully leased, sometimes I do, sometimes I don't, then sometimes it is generating income, and sometimes it's generating more expenses than income. Even though it's an asset.
Even though it's an asset, and I want to point out, we encounter this a lot with our high income service professionals. They follow the Murphy's Law of financial planning, where the expenses expand to consume all available income, and they'll ask us, well, gee, I'm making money, how come my assets aren't growing? My net worth is no better off than it was. And that's often because they have, as their income has grown with their profession, they've expanded their lifestyle and they're consuming the income. They have expenses on their P&L that takes it all, you know, on their personal profit and loss that consumes all the income. In theory, our expenses should be less than our income so that excess income, as you just pointed out, is feeding over to the balance sheet, and on the balance sheet is then acquiring assets which produce more income, which feed back on to the profit and loss, and there's this positive cycle where more income and more assets are created over time, as opposed to the negative cycle where we're creating more expenses and consuming our assets over time.
Right, and I probably should have pointed out that net worth may be a more common term for the equity section of the balance sheet, because people can look there and say, okay, my net worth is right there on the balance sheet. And Rick, the other thing I want to point out before we run out of time here is that if you use a canned accounting program, which most people do, and I would say, 80 or 90% of our clients use QuickBooks, and if you just set that up and you do it all on your own, you're going to end up with a profit and loss statement that is in alphabetical order. So you will have the income section, you will have the expense section, the expenses will be listed in alphabetical order. And I just want to point out that is not the best way to manage your business, because all businesses have kind of some logical ways to set up the different sections in the expense side of your P&L, which really help you to manage the business. For example, as I mentioned, we do a lot of work with dentists, and so we set up a section called non-doctor labor costs. We have variable costs, which are the costs that vary based on the number of procedures that they do. We have fixed costs, which don't vary based on that. For example, rent or, you know, having the lights on or those kind of things. And then we have another section where we put the doctor's compensation. And that really helps them just because that works in their particular business. It doesn't work in all businesses. It really helps them to be able to understand, okay, quickly, wow, my variable expenses are too high. And we kind of give them ranges so that they know if it's 20%, the variable costs are, you know, maybe I'm too high in that area, or if my fixed expenses are a certain percentage. So they really can be great tools for helping you run the business if you set them up correctly. And I think that's the point of the program, Rick, is to say that financial statements aren't mumbo jumbo. They actually do help us to run the business, and it's just a matter of sitting down with someone that really knows what's going on with them, set it up so that it works for your business, and they are flexible enough so that you can do that if you've got someone to work with that will help you. And we do that all the time for our clients, and it's the number one thing that that we get as feedback from our clients as to what helps them run their business and why they like doing business with us, because we don't try to keep it a black box. We want them to understand it, and we find that they prosper and we prosper over time,
right,
as they understand it better. So
as we're wrapping up here, if you don't have financial statements, please get some. We have a program for that. And if you don't understand your financial statements, get with somebody like us or somebody like us who can help you figure out what the heck those financial statements mean. Because if you're going to be in business and actually make money, you've got to use that tool, or you're just throwing your money away.
And we'll be back here again in another week on What About Wealth?
For listening to What About Wealth with hosts Rich Bloomfield and Rick Durfee. Please join us again for another edition next Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Until then, have a profitable week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.